So as to the matter at hand, so today we are celebrating the birth of the Buddha. And already somebody caught me on the way in and said, but hold on, today's not the Buddha's birthday. I looked it up on the... And I had to begin by saying, yes, you're right. There are different traditions, actually, in the what's called the Theravada tradition, mostly in Southeast Asia. They actually combined the Buddha's birth, the Buddha's enlightenment, and the Buddha's passing into kind of a three-day big event called Vesak, right? If you see. So we're calling it Vesak, but we're just celebrating the Buddha's birth. And traditionally in the Mahayana countries like China, Japan, Korea, so anyhow, the Theravada way is based on the lunar calendar. So Vesak keeps moving around, right? It can be in May, it can be in late April because it's based on lunar calendar. But the Mahayana countries chose dates and based on the solar calendar. So traditionally April 8th is celebrated as the birth of the Buddha. Just to clear up any confusion. So, the birth of the Buddha. Again, it's not, you know, we all celebrate birthdays, right? Right? Our own birthdays, we celebrate people in our families, close friends, we celebrate their birthdays. And especially if there's somebody that we really respect, really love, you know, their birthdays are more meaningful to us. Okay, so... So here we have this this man over 2,600 years ago who none of us physically knew and historically, you know, very difficult to relate to his time and his place and all that. And yet we celebrate his birth. Even though in Zen, and really Buddhism really begins with his enlightenment, you know, when we celebrate that in December and we do a lot of meditation and talk around the Buddha's enlightenment. Of course, the Buddha's enlightenment came out of his life, and his life began with his birth. And so, just like in Christianity, they celebrate Christmas, the birth of Jesus, people grateful that he took birth. We are very grateful that the Buddha took birth. In this lifetime. And it's very interesting because even though if you look in traditional accounts, there's a lot of mythological stuff about his birth and his family and, you know, six tusk elephants penetrating. He also supposedly had virgin birth, by the way, except it was from a white elephant with six tusks that kind of in a dream touched her in the side. And so that seems to be shared by a lot of religious traditions. Yes. But really, the Buddha was born into a family, kind of a principality. Sometimes his father's called the king, but you know we can't compare them to like the big kings, right? There were small principalities all within the Indian subcontext, Nepal, and so. But his father was but he was born into the royal family, Father very much wanted a son because in those days the sons would be the heirs and carry on the throne. So it's very interesting. So after the Buddha's birth, as traditional in that time and maybe still in parts of the world, astrology was very important. And so traditionally the soothsayer would be called in to do the astrological chart of the newborn. And what the astrologer reported back to the parents was, I see two roads for your son, right? He will, if he chooses one road, he will be a great king. He will be a great force in the world. He will be a great ruler, right? Which of course made his parents quite happy, to hear that, that was in his son's stars, so to speak. But then he said, but there is also another road also before him. And that is, he will become a great enlightened one and really benefit all of society. But to do that, he will renounce the world. So he will renounce the throne, he will renounce his nobility, he will renounce all that. And the thing that will move him, the astrologer said, in the direction of this renunciation, is that he will encounter impermanence in life. So even though he will have all the trappings of nobility growing up, if he encounters impermanence, the fact that all of it is transient and passing, including the body and life, he will therefore renounce the throne and move into a renunciate life. I think if most worldly parents, even short of being kings and queens, heard that choice for their child, they might do like the king did, which was clearly wanted his son to follow in his footsteps, have a great career, be successful in a worldly sense, and certainly didn't want him to become a renunciate, you know. And so that's what the king wanted for his son. And by the way, you might wonder what happened to his mother, Queen Maya. She died 5 or 7 days after the birth of the Buddha. Do you know why she died? By the way, all the mothers of future Buddhas die after their birth. Do you know why they die? They die because it would break their heart to see their child leave them at some point and leave the home and renounce it. So to spare her that pain. So again, you know, everything has meaning. But don't worry, she was given a place up in Tushita heaven, and when the Buddha, in the mythology of the Buddha's life, when he became the Buddha and fully enlightened later on, he visited her and liberated her. So he didn't forget, he was a good son right to the end. So, coming back to the Buddha, he has this birth, and with these two roads in front of him. And we know from the story, oh, and by the way, this is true, by the way. This is based on fact. I mean, the bare outline, and I just repeat that because a lot of people think, well, that's he really, you know, was he really a person? And yes, several generations after his passing, there was a great king who had become a Buddhist, Ashoka. And this is at a time, just several generations since the passing of the Buddha, where all the major places of his life were still remembered, you know, in the tradition. It hadn't passed that far. And he erected these pillars at all the major places in terms of the Buddha's life, including where, Kapilavastu, where, which was the kingdom, and Lumbini, the garden where he was born, and Bodh Gaya, where he became enlightened, and, you know, where he turned the wheel of the Dharma, and Sarnath, and where he died, and all that. So these pillars were erected with actually writing on them saying exactly what had happened there. And over time, of course, these pillars began to be covered up, right, by dirt and other things, you know, or new. So at a certain point, because even though Buddhism had spread throughout Asia, it had pretty much died out in India. So when the British, took over in the colonial times, took over India, the common story was the Buddha was born in India, but yet there was really no outward trace of the Buddha in India, but everyone else you know, all these names of these places. So actually, based on archaeological records, the British Archaeological Society started doing archaeological digs at these sites, and lo and behold, guess what they found? The Ashoka pillars. And all the Ashoka pillars then said, this is what happened here, this is what happened here, and they were scattered all around northern India. So we know that this, you know, that the outlines of his life are based on historical fact. So his father, having, you know, being the king, was able or did his best to create a bubble around Siddhartha. That was his name, Siddhartha. He created a bubble. He made sure that nothing unpleasant ever showed up in his life, right? And that all the changes of life, the impermanence of life, including sickness, old age, and death, were never experienced by him. So, and again, I think I think people who have been parents know that there's a certain level of protectiveness that parents try to bring to their child, but the king was excessive in his control. So therefore, Siddhartha grew up in this very protective bubble where everything was good, everything was safe, he was loved, he had everything he wanted, and he thought this was just the way a life was. And we know he was happy. Right? And you could imagine that any worldly person who had all their worldly needs taken care of and had a whole group of people, I mean, could you imagine, just imagine for yourself how wonderful your life would be if every one of your needs, every one of your desires was always met, and that you had a whole community of people around you who were devoted to making sure that your needs and wants got met. Wouldn't that be heaven? You see? So his father, Suddhodana, tried to create a heaven for him. But again, in the telling of the Buddha's life, at a certain point, he somehow was aware of his isolation, right? Because he was really not allowed out of the compound of the palace, or when he went from one of his palaces to here or there, you know, people would always go before him to make sure nothing unpleasant was ever seen. He would never see a sick person, he would never see a dead person, he would never see, heaven forbid, he should see an old person. I mean, so he was in this environment. But somehow he somehow figured out that, you know, that somehow he was missing something. So again, bottom line, very happy. And yet, something was nagging at him. And so, secretly, he inveigled his charioteer to take him out into the town of Kapilavastu, you know, without people running in front, getting everybody away who looked presentable to him. And of course, what we know is over these coming days, the Buddha saw sick people, he saw old people, and he saw death, he saw dead people. Because if anybody has been to India, we know that traditionally when someone died, they were carried very much through the community, carried to the burning ghats, so everything was very public, right? There was nothing to hide. And so he was able to see very clearly that this little bubble he had believed in was not true, was not really the way things were. And if you could imagine, well, again, we don't have to imagine because I think we've all been through this one. Is that not true? Maybe that's why we're here, right? Because we're here because things are impermanent, because things change, because we can't hold on to things, right? And things change in many ways. They change in positive ways, they change in painful ways. You know, we get what we want, we don't get what we want, they like us, they don't like us, things break. So I think in a certain way, knowing the power, when really one comes face to face with the impermanent nature of everything, especially our own bodies and the bodies of those we love and care about, knowing that everyone and everything is prone to getting sick, and getting sick means from the common cold to cancer and all kinds of diseases that these bodies attract. We know that aging is normal for everyone, and that we know that death is normal, right? Death is normal. Everyone dies. Everyone has died. Everyone alive now will die, and that is not a, you know, that's not a a bummer. Well, of course, it is a bummer, but it is a fact. And so when the Buddha encountered this, he was really shocked. Right? I mean, it was like, you know, like supposedly in the telling of it, you know, when he would see these things, he would ask his charioteer, you know, what is that? You know, yeah, what is that? A person with this stuff running out of their nose and their eyes all rheumy and they're, you know, coughing and sneezing. Like, what is that? Right? Because he didn't know, he'd never seen it. And the charioteer says, well, that's, you know, well, that's just sickness. And people get sick. Siddhartha goes, hold on, you mean I have the potential to get sick? Well, of course. You mean, and everybody, you know, else has it? Of course, you know. So it was, you know, and then he'd come back and, you know, that like that would be enough for a couple of days. You know, and then he'd go out again, you know, and they'd see an old person. And you know, don't take this personally for those who are aging. You know, the descriptions were not very complimentary. I mean, he was young. He was very vibrant. He was young and he was in his 20s, you know, so, you know, very full of himself. And it's the vibrancy of his youth, and he thought it was going to last forever. And when he saw aging people, you know, he was I don't know if he was disgusted, but certainly it was not complimentary, the descriptions, to be honest. Again, you know, asking the charioteer, what is that? Oh, that's aging. Oh, like, is that going to happen to me? Of course it is. Is that going to happen to all my loved ones? Even had a child by then? Yes, of course. Oh, goes back to the palace, continues to eat at him, doesn't tell anybody what's going on. And then he has the third one, which was death, when he sees a dead person. And, you know, again, the same dialogue. What is that? Is that going to happen to me? Is that going to happen to all my loved ones? Yes. Yes, this is normal. This happens to everyone and everything. So that supposedly, I mean, that was like the final blow, because sort of sickness and aging are part of the process, right? But you could still have all your things, and you could still have your status, and you could still enjoy life, you know what I'm saying? Even though these, right? You know, because like, you know, we can recover from our sickness, and we can age, but we can learn to take care of ourselves and, you know, work with it. But there was something about death. It's final. It's like it's all over. So it's not only, you know, that this whole body that he's so identified with and lavished so much attention on and was so proud of, you know, was going to cease to exist, but that everything that he related to, you know, his position, right, and his things and his status and his relationships, all ultimately, what can I say, meaningless, but meaningless, I'm not telling anybody to think, oh, it's all meaningless, but I mean meaningless in the biggest picture, because it doesn't last. It's all going to come to an end, right? It's sort of like, you know, it's sort of like going somewhere on vacation. You have really two wonderful weeks, but then what happens? Anybody ever been on vacation and it comes to an end, right? Yeah, it's like, oh, you mean this really nice hotel room I can't live forever in? And, you know, there could be waiters taking care of me all the time and people bringing me drinks by the pool. I mean, that's not going to last forever. Okay, so it's sort of like that, you know. So, but this was even bigger, right? I mean, everything was impermanent. Nothing lasts. So basically, you know, what we, you know, this is my own extrapolation. I think this really precipitated a depression in him. Just, right? We talk about depression, like everything became flat. Right? It's like all of a sudden he's like going through his daily activities and, you know, going to the parties, and, you know, all the stuff, but it's all kind of flat. Right? Because he realized this, it's all just fluff, you know what I mean? It's all temporary. You know, none of it's going to last. Every pleasure ends. Right? So he was flat. But then he asked to go out again. And on the third time, he saw a man who was in a simple robe. His feet were bare. I'm not sure if he had a shaved head, but in India the sadhus often have long hair, they don't shave. So anyhow, he saw this very unusual looking man who just was carrying a begging bowl and a few things on his back, and Siddhartha was very struck by him because he seemed to radiate peace. Right? Great peace. Calmness. He walked with that kind of awareness, right? And so the Buddha was like, same thing, like, what's that? Or who's that, you see? He asked the charioteer, and the charioteer says, oh, he's a renunciate, right? So even this is before Buddhism, you know, there was a Vedic, strong Vedic tradition in India, and there was a tradition of renunciation and people going off and renouncing the world and living, you know, according to meditation, other kinds of ritualistic practices. So Siddhartha goes, well, you know, so what's a renunciate? It's somebody, explained, it's somebody who's renounced his worldly life. He's left his home. He's left the world of possessions. He's left, having his own home. He just wanders about. He begs his food. He lives very simply. He carries on his back, maybe a change of clothes and maybe a blanket. Right? You know, very simple living. And so the Buddha is very struck by this, because if you can imagine his life, which was a life based on what? Many, 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 many things, right? And many, many, many beautiful things, and, lots of all that, you know. And yet, he looks over here and sees, but here's this guy, this man, who has nothing. He has nothing. I mean, I have everything. Plus, I have the status, and I have the servants, and I get all this. He has nothing. And yet, he walks with such peace. Right? So he was very, what we know, that really kind of, that obviously had a great impression on him. Right? But it also, obviously, this is my own interpretation, within his crisis, which really didn't have a way out, you see, because it was either like you just embrace like this hedonistic, you know, live for the moment, but not in the way we live for the moment, but live for the moment for pleasure and gain and all that, you know. It's either you live that, or you're just kind of depressed, because you're, you know, it's sort of like nihilism, right? It's like, you know, God, nothing has any meaning. You know, the whole thing adds up to nothing, because in the end, I'm going to have to leave everything. So I think that's where he was at, you know, that conundrum, when all of a sudden he realized, oh, there is another way. See, there is a way to happiness in life. There is a way to having inner peace and surety, but it's not the way of indulgence and denial and being blind to what's going on in life. It's a, right? And yet it's not nihilism, because he was very, you know, it's not depression. Okay. So he was very struck by that. And again, please remember, at that time, that was sort of the way it is. There was like the worldly life, and then there was the, you know, and then the few who left and renounced. And so he stewed on that, right? You know, we don't know how long he stewed on it. Again, remember, he was married at the time. He had a child. He was the heir to the throne. He was, you know, everybody's favorite guy. Right? Well loved, well liked, you know, had all the attributes. So he had a lot going for him. And yet, at the end of his own inner process, he decided he had to leave. So we will talk more when we get to in December, when we celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment. We'll talk more about his spiritual journey and how it ended up with this great enlightenment, which really is where, it's from his great enlightenment that he taught. He didn't teach from study, even though he was familiar with the Vedic treatises. It really was out of his enlightenment that he was able to liberate himself, resolve the contradictions, and really discovered there is a path, a way to live in life in an awakened way. That one can live in the midst of worldly life, in the midst of things, in the midst of relationships, and yet have that inner happiness and inner peace. In our community, we call that engaged Buddhism. Buddhism that's engaged in life, in the world. So, again, for those of us who are recipients of this 2,600-year-old tradition, for those of us who feel we have benefited from coming in contact with the teachers and the masters of this tradition, both the practices, the teachings, the philosophy, the psychology, you know, sort of help make things clear and give a methodology for our own healing and transformation. Obviously, we are usually most grateful for our teachers, because they're the ones in this life who've shown us the way. They are the manifestations of Dharma. But again, if in Buddhism, the authentic transmission of the Buddha's teachings from teacher to student can be traced back to the Buddha. Right? So it has been a transmission where students have received the authorization to teach the Dharma from their teacher, who hopefully got their authorization from their teacher. And so ideally, it is an unbroken lineage. But guess who it goes back to? Shakyamuni, who was, his name was Siddhartha when he was in the family. For those of you who read Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, right? So Siddhartha was his family name. And he was of the Shakya clan. So that's why he's called Shakyamuni. Muni is sort of like sage, awakened one of the Shakyas. So again, we, you know, it's sort of an ancestral thing, right? That we are grateful to our current teachers who've shown us, you know, who've introduced us to the Dharma and interpreted the Dharma so we can make use of it and shown us how to practice and nurtured us along the path. But of course, we understand that they're only there because of their teacher or teachers, who are only there because of their teacher and teachers, who are only there because of their teacher and teachers, you know, going back, you know, multiple generations for 2,600 years in this unbroken transmission that is now coming to Florida, of all places. And of course, not just us, but there are other Buddhist teachers here. So traditionally, you know, the Buddha's birthday is acknowledged in a simple ceremony. So this, I don't know if everybody can see this or if you can zoom it. So this is the classic representation of the baby Buddha, who may not look like your typical 1-hour-old infant. But because supposedly, as soon as he was born to his mother, he took 7 steps. So again, highly unusual. He took 7 steps, and at each of his steps, a lotus grew at his feet. So he grew on lotuses. And then supposedly he said something, and this is why, you know, you can see one finger's pointing up and one finger's pointing down. Can you see that's a representation of the baby Buddha? Because he is purported to have said, so not only could he walk at birth, but he could speak at birth, which is quite special. And he said something, and it's got to be interpreted because it sounds like the height of egoism. He says, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone am. Or sometimes it said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I am the only one. Now again, that could sound like the height of egotism, but it's a one with a capital O, right? It's not a self one. It's not a personal one. It's not a self-identity one. It's the oneness of everyone. So he's really saying, you know, above the heavens and below the heavens. So above the heavens and below the heavens is everywhere, right? So everywhere there is only one, right? And basically he's kind of announcing. Of course, I don't think his parents picked up on it at the time. You know who he was. Because again, please, you know, if you kind of, you know, buy into the greater stories of the Buddha, he had many, 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 many lives prior to his emergence, and they are documented in the Jataka tales, which describe many, 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 many stories of his birth, both as a human being and as an animal, a bird, a deer, you know, all kinds of, took many births. But in each of those, he demonstrated selflessness. He demonstrated compassion. And so the sense was that, you know, he didn't just somebody as awake as he was, or had the potential, didn't just come out of nowhere. But if you have some belief in rebirth, it was a process that now had come to full bloom, right? So So if any of you ever have children and they come out and say things like that, understand, you know, you're getting the finished product, right? But again, you know, I mean, it's exceptional, but it's not unknown. I mean, anybody, you know, knows within themselves. It's like, you know, especially for those of us who were not born into a Buddhist family, it's like, why are we here? You know, like, it doesn't make sense, does it? You see, that we'd be here. Unless we had some sense that there was something else in me. You know, that somehow has always been in me. And now it's just manifesting. Right. And so, you know, the extraordinariness of the Buddha's life may seem extraordinary, but again, I don't think it's that far-fetched. We see, and if anybody has been around children, their own children, others' children, teaching children, you know, they're a mixed bag, kids, aren't they? I mean, some are kind of naturally very what? Very giving, very loving, very selfless, right? And some kids, anyhow, we won't go into it. But, you know, there's a whole spectrum, right? There's a whole spectrum of kids, right? And I understand, you know, parenting and all that. But it's. I think if you've been around little children, you realize there is a uniqueness, right? That's apparent very, very early on, you see. And when we understand that, we are more intelligent about how we nurture the seeds in children, especially those wholesome ones, those good ones, to bring those forth, and very careful not to nurture seeds that are antithetical to them fulfilling this nobler path in life. So we are grateful that in spite of everything, you know, the Buddha found his way, you know, out of that trap that his family set for him, and had the power, even with all the wonderful things in his life, to see through it, and to you know, dedicate his life to his own awakening, and then, you know, after his awakening, which happened when he was about 29, 30 years old, he dedicated the next 50 years of his life, you know, wandering India, teaching anybody and everybody. Nobility, poor peasants, untouchables. I mean, he would just, you know, he was open to teaching anybody, gathered hundreds, thousands of disciples. And from that transmission, from him to his disciples, you know, that's how Buddhism spread in India and then eventually began to spread throughout Asia. So today we have some kids here. I know it's Memorial Day weekend, so not all of them could be here. And they're going to be coming in soon. And then we're going to, so tradition is, so if you go to places like Asia, India, it's very typical that if you're going to kind of honor something like this image, you might offer it sweet water, right? Or pouring water over the image is a way of showing respect, okay? So if you'll see, so this bowl contains sweet tea, okay? And there are two little spatulas, and we are going to be coming up for those who want, and bowing and offering, pouring tea over the Buddha. But the kids are going to go first. So again, please remember, this is not idol worship. So in a sense, we are not, you know, this image, the statue of the baby Buddha, it just represents, you know, what does it really represent? It really represents the potential in all of us, right? The potential in all of us to become Buddhas, which is really the basis of the Buddha's enlightenment. So please, when you pour water over the Buddha, please remember you're really in your mind making offerings to somebody who showed the potential in all human beings to be awake. So I see little shadows back there. The kids go first. You know, children tend to be impatient. So we'll let them come first. And then Diana is going to be playing music. You want to come on up? Oh, we're going to start with incense offering. So the kids can't come in yet? All right. If anybody wants to know who's really running thing, it's Jacqueline over here. So we're going to offer incense as the kids come in. Thank you, Jacqueline. Jacqueline's told me this a half a dozen times. So Diana, our cellist, is going to offer the incense on behalf of all of us. And the children are coming in, and it looks like they made lanterns. And maybe somebody will tell us when they come up what they represent. So you'll offer incense, and Jacqueline will offer the chant.
Time to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. May it be fragrant as earth herself, reflecting careful efforts, wholehearted awareness, and the fruit of understanding slowly ripening. May we and all beings be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. May we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home.
So I've been just given a bracelet that says Om Mani Padme Hum, made by the children. You guys are too much. Thank you. So have you explained to them what we're doing today?
Yes.
So you guys know about the baby Buddha and why we bathe him, right? Did your parents ever, when you were little, give you a bath? Yeah, so that's, you know, we're just taking care of the Buddha today.
So Bodhi here is going to tell everybody what we did at the family program today before we came.
Today is the Buddha's birthday, and we made paper lanterns, and we made bracelets. And I learned about the life of the Buddha.
All right, so thank you, kids.
So again, kids, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to we're going to come up here in a line, and we see the baby Buddha. This is a special statue that we only take out today. because this is a statue of the baby Buddha. And I told people earlier, as you've learned, he was an incredible special because, can you believe it? He could walk and talk right at his birth. I don't think anybody here could do that, could they? I don't think so. Very special. So, because it's his birthday, we want to honor him, and the traditional way to honor him is to offer sweet tea to him. So we will come up here, and we will bow, and in your mind, whatever good wishes you have, right, in your own privacy of your own, whatever good wishes you have for yourself, for your family, for the world, you can just say it to yourself, right, as you bow, and then we come over, and we scoop up some of the sweet tea, and we pour it over the Buddha. Okay, and then we put it down.
And I'll help.
And Karina will help, we'll bow, and then we can go sit down. Right, so we're on two sides. So we can,
Liam and
the kids can make a line. Yeah, that's sweet tea.
I'll help. And kids, you can pick up your lanterns to bring home after the ceremony, okay? Okay.
Yeah, you can use that. Yeah, we're there too, so you can. And then after the kids are done, we can all come up, those who want to come up. And the parents can come up. The parents want to come up now with their kids? They can do that if they'd like. And Diana can play some music, and we're off and running. Thank you. So if everybody else who wants to participate, please just line up in the center and come on down. And we can do two at a time. There are two ladles. So just... you, everyone. Thank you, Diana.